I think you also learn, and I think it's a great word for Christians who work in a secular environment, that you're not going to gain people's respect by compromising God's ways.
This podcast is brought to you by Blackaby Ministries International. To find out more, visit blackaby.org.
Well, welcome everyone to the Richard Blackaby Leadership Podcast, helping take our leadership to the next level. My name is Sam Camp, and I'm joined by Dr. Richard Blackaby.
Well, thanks for having me, Sam.
It's always a pleasure, Richard, to have you on your own podcast, as I often say at these things. Well, before we get into the lighthearted subject of today, I just want to remind our listeners that Richard is going to be at The Cove, just outside Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah.
That's a great, great facility. It's a very tranquil place if you've never been. I highly encourage you to go. But that's going to be May 15th through 17th. You're going to be talking on the ways of God based on the book that you've written about the ways of God. And it's just we're excited about that. All the accommodations are full on campus, but you can get on the wait list. And you can still attend and stay locally. But anything else you want to mention about that before we dive in?
It never hurts to get on the wait list because there's always some cancellations last minute. So get your name on there and you might be able to stay right there on site. But you might actually be able to get even cheaper accommodations at a Holiday Inn nearby. There's one just barely off campus. You can get a Holiday Inn and drive on site for the conferences themselves. Yeah. And you can also get a meal pass there. So you go over to the Cove to eat in the dining room and you can hang out there during the day and eat frozen yogurt while looking out on the Blue Ridge Mountains. It's great. And just
tough to beat, and it'll be a great conference as well. And those are always really well done. There's a great facility. And
if you've never been there before, it's Billy Graham. It was kind of his vision to just have a place where you could just get away, hear good Bible teaching, and just get kind of connected with in sync with God again. Maybe you've got some issues that you just want to pray through, and it's just a good place to get some teaching and then have lots of time to just be on your own or hike up to the top of the mountain and just have some time with the Lord too.
Well, and there's just something really great about setting aside time and getting away and being, you know, away from your ordinary circumstances that I think can be very powerful and enriching.
There's wonderful people. I know a number of people who are coming, and they're awesome Christians from all walks of life, and that's just some of the beauty of that. It's just getting to know some amazing Christians who've all gathered together, and they're kind of processing some of the teaching together, and it's a lot of really good things happen every time. So,
well, good. And we'll, as always, we'll leave links to that in the show notes. You can find out more at The Cove, I believe it's .org, but that'll all be in the show notes. What's not in the show notes is
today's podcast.
Today's podcast. We're diving into the light and
frivolous,
joyful topic of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, you know, Sam, I thought I'd kind of do something a little bit different. Of course, I love just digging into passages of Scripture, and especially I think as they apply to what we're facing in these days. And so I wanted to just unpack a bit of chapter 19 of Genesis. And of course, you are in a Bible study that I teach every Sunday at our church, and we've been going through Genesis. And so we were in this passage recently, and we had about 40 or so adults in the room, and there's a lot of discussion most weeks, just chewing on what the Bible says and how it applies. And
well, in Genesis, you know, it's such a rich book.
Yeah. So I just thought, just seeing some of the discussion, and I just thought it might be good just to touch on some of that here today. And so when you get to Genesis 19, you have to pretty well just know in most cases here, of course, it's an ongoing story, so it's always good to know what happened just before this. And so if you look back a chapter or so, Abraham is, he's at this time about 99 years old, sitting in his tent in the desert, and all of a sudden he sees three visitors walking up. And so he somehow, I think, senses these are not ordinary visitors, but it is basically a manifestation of God and two angels. And so he quickly pleads with them to wait while he goes out and makes them a nice meal, and treats them like royalty, and shows them great respect. And so while they're there, they basically the God figure says, basically, this time next year, Sarah's going to have a child. And Sarah actually laughs to herself. She's in the tent, but she's, of course, tents have very thin walls. And so she hears this and she laughs because at this point she's quite old and just knows that it's humanly impossible. And God hears her laughing from inside the tent and says, why did she laugh? And I love that in the sense that there are things, I think if God were to tell us everything that he intends to do in our life, I think we might be tempted to laugh as well.
And
God would say, well, what are you laughing for? I'm very serious about this. And so they have that discussion. And but then you get the second part of that chapter, quite famous, because in verse 17, it says, then the Lord said, should I hide what I'm about to do from Abraham? And that is a fascinating thing. Of course, what he is planning to do is to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And then he's about to move on. And he stops and kind of, you know, states this, I guess, to the other angels that are with him, or the angels that are with him, and just says, you know, should we let him know? And of course, it's interesting because Abraham is the only person in the Bible that the Bible specifically says that he was a friend of God. It says that in several different places. James says that, Isaiah, and somewhere else, Chronicles, I think. And it's interesting because in John chapter 15, verse 14, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, you are my friends if you do what I command you. I do not call you servants anymore, because a servant doesn't know what his master is doing. I have called you friends because I have made known to you everything I've heard from my Father. And I think that's interesting. Part of being a friend of God is that he shares his heart with you.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what prayer is all about, is that when you're in a conversation with God, you can't tell him anything he doesn't know, but there's lots he could tell you. And I think sometimes when there's confusing circumstances going on in our world, crises taking place, I think sometimes we don't need to necessarily get on our knees and immediately start telling God what we think he should do about the economy or about the Middle East or about Ukraine. I think sometimes we need just to seek to hear what God is thinking about those things, what he intends to do.
And so
I think in a sense that's what's happening here. God sees Abraham as a friend of his, and he's just been in a conversation with him, and he's been talking to Abraham about what he plans to do in Abraham's life. But then I think God just decides, well, let's tell Abraham what we're also going to be doing in the world around him. It's not directly affecting him, although he's got a nephew that lives in Sodom at the time. But I think, and I just have so many memories of my dad when there was a crisis like 9/11 or something, and he would have the news on watching what was the newscast, but then he'd also have his Bible and a notebook, and he'd be saying, okay, well, here's what apparently is happening in the world right now, but God, what's on your heart and mind? What are you doing in the midst of this? And help me understand what you're doing. And so I think that's kind of what is happening here. And so when you get to chapter 9, so anyway, then, there, you know, of course, that famous discussion where God, where Abraham intercedes for Sodom and says, well, would you destroy this city if there were 50 righteous people? And of course, God says, no, I'd spare it for 50. And then he goes to 40 and then 30, then 20. And then he's audacious enough to say, well, what if I can even round up 10 righteous people? Would you spare the city then? And God says, yes. And so two things that strike me about that. One is it tells you something, first of all, about the patience of God, that at a certain point, God's patience runs out, that a nation, a city, a people can become so wicked that ultimately God says, enough is enough. You have been an abomination to me. You've flaunted your sin and celebrated it for so long. And at a certain point, you cross a line with God. And I don't know where that line is, but there are places in the Bible, just a few chapters back, in when God is dealing with Noah, he says, the world has crossed that line, and so I've lost my patience. But at the same time, so in one sense, Sodom and Gomorrah is kind of a poster child of when a righteous God has just had enough And it's a terrifying thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you also see the grace of God, because this city is so depraved that God says the sins are crying out all the way to heaven. I can't help but just be offended by the sin taking place in that city. And yet he says, but if you even find 10 people, I'll spare it. And I've often thought, this is a wonderful potential example of what a righteous person can do. Maybe you work in a very secular company where it's led by very non-Christian kind of executives, but you're a Christian and God's put you there. Maybe you're on the shop floor. Maybe you're in the management team. But how many Christians does it take for God to choose to show grace to that people, that city, that church, that is perhaps doing some really sinful things, but because you're there and you're righteous, God says, "Well, I'm not going to give them what they deserve because you're there." And so when you get to chapter 19, it starts off. It says the two angels entered Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in Sodom's gateway. And it's interesting, Lot. In many ways, I feel like this whole chapter 19 is really about Lot. You've just been studying Abraham, who, and when Abraham starts off following a God, he's really he starts off well. He leaves his homeland and his brother, and he follows God wherever God leads, and it starts off well. But by the time you get to the second half of chapter 12 in Genesis, Abraham runs into his first real crisis in a famine, and he panics and he stops checking in with God, doesn't care what God has told him to do. And he uses common wisdom. He flees into Egypt, and then he tells his wife, "You need to lie and say that you're my sister. And because otherwise Pharaoh might kill me, and take you as his wife." And so, completely driven by his own self-preservation, he turns his wife into a liar. And then they come and, because he has lied, the very thing he's trying to avoid is what he helps enable. And they assume, well, this woman's not married apparently, so I'm going to take her as my wife. And so Abram just kind of goes down a dark path for a while. But by the end of that chapter, Abram has been humiliated, humbled, exposed, and not that he is perfect after that, but he really starts on a journey where God begins to really build his character. And over the course of several chapters, he still has his setbacks for sure, but Abram begins to grow. Now with Lot, you were introduced to Lot around the same time we're introduced to Abraham, but I would suggest that he starts off with a very small, self-centered character, and the last time you see him in the Bible, he still has a small, self-centered kind of character. But you find Lot here sitting at the gate of Sodom, and of course, that typically means if you're sitting at the gate, that means you're probably one of the elders. That's what the elders did. That's where the law courts were. You sat at the gate of a city, and if there was any kind of civil dispute, you went to the city gate, you found whatever elders were there, you presented your case, and they would rule. And so the first time that you see Lot moving towards Sodom, you find it in chapter 13 of Genesis, and it says, you know, when Abraham and Lot part ways, there's not enough grazing land for both of them. So Abram very graciously says, "Well, Lot, you choose. What do you want? Which way do you want to go?" And to the east is this lush foliage and grazing land, and to the east there is, and to the west you see barren wilderness. And so Lot very selfishly, disrespectfully picks the good land. And so he sends his uncle into the desert while he goes toward the lush valley area. And so as he goes there, it just says that he moved toward Sodom. And that's a very interesting phrase in chapter 13, verse 12. It just says he moved, he wasn't in Sodom, but he was just in the vicinity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the great, I think one of the amazing studies in this chapter is Lot's a businessman, and he would be a God-fearing, you could call him righteous businessman, but he chooses to live in a very evil society. And sometimes you can't help it. I mean, sometimes that's just the culture of the country you live in, the city you live in. But you're a righteous person, and you're trying to maintain your righteousness when you're surrounded by wickedness. And you know, the Bible tells us in Matthew 5 that we're supposed to be salt and light. So it might well be that God lets you go, and he leads you to go work in a business that's has a lot of darkness. And he says, go and shine there. And one righteous person can exert a huge influence on a community. And you might think to yourself, we don't know how long that Lot ends up living in Sodom, but clearly it's for a number of years. And you would think, okay, you've got a wife, two daughters, so there's at least four of you to start with that are all righteous, hopefully. Could four righteous people living in a city ultimately at least gain six more converts? If they had, then God would have spared Sodom. Mm-hmm. All you had to do is reach six people in a city you lived in, year in and year out. But Lot will discover that he has not even converted his own sons-in-law, but he has worked up the political ladder, and he is now he's an elder. And so, yeah. What's interesting is that in chapter 13, it just says Lot moved toward Sodom, and then when you get to chapter 14, verse 12, Sodom is captured by some invaders. And they take the people living in Sodom away in captivity. And then apparently Lot and his family live in Sodom. So at first Lot just was going to be in the vicinity of a very wicked place. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, he's in the midst of the wicked place. And by the time you get to chapter 19, he is one of the leaders in the wicked place. He's enmeshed in the wicked place.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, there's a difference between you being in Sodom and Sodom being in you. And it just seems as if there's always that danger. And I've seen so many Christians who said, I'm going to be a witness. I'm going to make a difference. But instead of them making a difference, their environment made a difference on them. And you know, there's not a set answer on that. I've had people say, well, do you think I should work in this environment? Like I had someone the other day tell me that they felt led to run for government and they were going to make a difference. And I asked them, I said, well, are you aware that there's been many, many devout Christians who wanted to go into government to make a difference, but government ended up, politics ended up making a difference on them. Mm-hmm. And they sold out their integrity to all kinds of lobbyists and the pressures of colleagues. And now they've just become like everybody else. And so the question always is, is your walk with God such that you can withstand Sodom? And if you can't, then maybe don't put yourself in that place. Some people just can't handle that pressure. And so no point in just putting yourself in a place where you're going to crumble and lose your witness. And that's seems like a lot of what Lot's going to do. Now, he doesn't necessarily sacrifice his own morality, but it's very hard to enmesh yourself with other ungodly people and then not face consequences. And so he's sitting there at the gate. He's at least acting like a leader. He's at least going through the motions of being a leader. But of course, the real test of a leader is not that you're sitting at the city gate, but that people heed what you say.
Yeah.
And what we're going to find is nobody takes Lot seriously. He goes through the motions of being a leader, but he doesn't actually lead anybody. And no one takes him seriously. And so he has these guests come in evening. And of course, it's I think the Bible often tells a great story. And here it's getting to be dark. And of course, evil tends to come out at night. And so these two angelic beings show up, we don't know for sure if he recognizes right away that they're angelic beings or messengers from God, or if he's just being polite, because in one sense, one of the most cardinal rules in the Middle East at that time was that you just had to show hospitality. Yeah, you had to open your home, you had to treat guests well, And oftentimes, even to this day, you can be in a Middle Eastern home and they will almost embarrass you with their generosity. Oftentimes they will, they'll give you the very best that they have, whether they can afford to or not. And that's just ingrained into that culture. And so he insists that they come into his house, and at first they push back and they say, we'd rather spend the night in the square. But it says he urged them so strongly that they followed him and went into his house, prepared a feast and baked unleavened bread for them, and they ate. And of course, this feast he makes is not of the same caliber and quality as what Abraham's going to make for these same angels the day before. Perhaps he's just in a hurry. Maybe it's later at night, but Lot doesn't necessarily, he's always kind of looking out for himself. He's trying to go through the motions of being hospitable, but he doesn't seem to want it to cost him too much. There's a limit. And so just even what he makes, unleavened bread and so on, is a quick kind of meal. Like, it's like he's making them, I'll whip up a grilled cheese sandwich for you. You know, Abraham goes out and kills the fatted calf. But Lot whips up unleavened bread and so on. And so so it says, though, verse 4, that before they went to bed, the men of the city of Sodom, both young and old, the whole population surrounded the house, and they called out to Lot, and they want to know where those men are. And they want to have homosexual relations with them, is what they're asking for. And so Lot goes to the door, and he says, don't do this evil, my brothers. Look, I've got two daughters who haven't been intimate with a man. I'll bring them out to you, and you can do whatever you want to them. However, don't do anything to these men, because they have come under the protection of my roof. And of course, this is appalling to us as we read it today. We think, this is the good guy? He's offering his two innocent daughters to this rabble mob in order to preserve these two angels. And which makes you kind of wonder as well what his view of these angels were, because, you know, if you really knew they were angels, you probably would just have said, you would have not offered your daughters. You would have just told the angels to fend for themselves. But he's trying to be, he wants to keep the image of being hospitable, being a good host. And basically he's willing to sacrifice his own daughters in order to keep his own reputation, his own standing. And you realize there's really, it's a no win, right? Because you don't want to turn these angels over to this mob, but you also don't want to turn your daughters over. And Lot, because he's so enmeshed in this wicked society, he basically, no matter what he does at this point, it's going to be wrong. It's going to hurt innocent, good people. And that happens at times when you get yourself so enmeshed in an evil culture, an evil society, that a day arises where basically no matter what you choose, it's going to be bad. And so they reject it. They said, get out of the way. And they said something interesting. Verse 9, they said, this one came here as an alien, but he's acting like a judge, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? By the way, when you don't outright condemn people's evil behavior, sometimes just being a godly person that chooses to, in your own life, to do the right thing, people will feel condemned and put down. I don't know if you ever just had people accuse you of being, you know, judgmental, and you hadn't even said anything.
Yeah.
I had people leave my church one time when I was a pastor because they assumed what I would say about their lifestyle without ever having talked to me. But here he's trying to lead, he's trying to be an elder, and the people are not taking him seriously. In fact, they call him an alien. It's interesting because he calls them brothers. He says, don't do this evil, my brothers. But they call him an alien. And so he's an outsider. I think he wants to fit in. He wants to be respected. But I think you also learn, and I think it's a great word for Christians who work in a secular environment, that you're not going to gain people's respect by compromising God's ways. And you may just be trying to fit in, but instead of being respected because you fit in and you look like everybody else, they'll actually lose even more respect for you. And they'll still see you as an alien. And so they start to press upon Lot to break down the door. And the angels have basically had enough. And so they pull Lot inside, and then they actually, they strike the men with blindness so that they can't see. And it's interesting, I think in the New King James, it says that that the men, even though they're blind now, they still kept wandering about trying to feel their way to the door, still trying to get in. They can't even see. You'd think that once you've been struck blind, you'd be more concerned about getting your sight back than trying to get these two strangers. But I think the scripture kind of shows you a bit of the depravity.
Yeah.
They're so depraved that they still want to satisfy their lust, even though they've been physically blinded. And so then you just kind of, you know this story, but the angels, then they turn and they said, is there anyone else that needs to be saved? And of course, here at this point, Lot is going to discover the extent of his influence. Here he's trying to be an elder. He's trying to be a leader. None of the men in the city took him seriously. And now he's going to go to his two sons-in-law and he's going to plead with them and say, destruction is coming. You've got to get out of the city right away. And I think one of the saddest phrases in this whole passage is verse 14. It says, but his sons-in-law thought he was joking. In other words, they didn't take him seriously either.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked before about the influence a leader exerts, hopefully for good, on those around them. But how sad if maybe you saw in one of your kids, they were toying with drugs, they were toying with loose morals. And you knew that if they kept on doing that, they were just playing with fire, that it was just a matter until they got burned. And how many parents have pled with their children to be careful, to turn from their wicked ways, and the children didn't take them seriously. And then they come home pregnant one day, or they come home addicted to drugs, or they get arrested. They're in a drinking and driving accident. And then all of a sudden, the reality comes crashing down, and the parent realizes, I tried to tell them, but they didn't take me seriously. And I thought to myself, what a tragic thing if you lived your life in such a way that when you tried to speak things of God, that no one took you seriously. Because your life perhaps just hadn't backed it up. And so your words just had no impact. It's interesting because later a Philistine is going to come in the very next chapter or so to Abraham. Well, I guess a couple chapters later, and Abimelech is going to say to Abram, and we know that God is with you in everything you do. That's pretty interesting. That a pagan just watching Abraham's life says, it's obvious to us that God is with you in whatever you do. But nobody is saying that with Lot. No one is saying, hey, you know, it seemed like everything Lot does, God blesses, so we better take this guy seriously. And so I think you see kind of a difference there. And so then just, you know, this story, but as his sons-in-law won't go with him. But then it says the angels said, they urged Lot, saying, get up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. And then these amazing words of verse 16, but he hesitated. Now, if angels were urging me to hurry out of the city before destruction came, I don't know how much hesitating there'd be. You could imagine thinking, okay, well, where's my safety deposit box? You know, where's all my tax returns? You know, where's the cash box, my safe? What do I want to make sure I escape with if this whole city's going to be destroyed? And the angels finally, just out of compassion for him and his family, they'd grab him by the hand and just pretty well brush him out of the city. He can't even be decisive about heeding God's voice, even when angels are telling him, you're about to die if you stay here. He still needs encouragement to do that. And I just think that's the difference between Lot and Abraham. You know, God tells Abraham to do something, and it says he got up early in the morning and he set out to do it. With Lot, the angels got to grab him by the hand and say, I'm serious, you got to do this now. And so they get him outside the city, and then they said, don't look back, don't stop anywhere on the plain, run to the mountains or you will be swept away. And then again, it says, but Lot said to them, no, my Lord. And he says, it's the mountains are too far. It'll be too hard. Can I just go to that little village over in Zoar? It won't exert me nearly so much. My heart's not what it used to be. And again, you'd think, someone tells me you're going to die if you don't run as fast as you can to that mountain over there. Yeah, I would say let's get running
over there. Yeah.
But even then, Lot just he's trying to, he's always looking out. In one sense, he's always looking for the easiest route. It's like, okay, when he and Abram split up, well, it's hard herding sheep in a desert, so I'm going to take the easier route in the pasture land. Well, it's hard to farm outside the city. I could live inside the city and have grocery stores nearby. And it just seemed like it's always, well, what's the easiest thing?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, just most of the time, the things really worth having in life don't come easy. They come with sacrifice and integrity and work. And so even as they're finally fleeing to the town of Zoar, his own wife looks back famously and is turned into a pillar of salt. And you think again, Lot doesn't even have enough influence over his own wife to just tell her, honey, whatever you do, we've got to heed what the angels have just told us. It's life and death. Whatever you do, don't look back. And it may well be that he married his wife out of Sodom. She might have been a Sodomite. And she's worried about her family, and she cares more about them than she cares about what God has said. And of course, it costs her. And so Lot gets to Zoar, but then he gets worried that he's worried about himself. It says that he worried that they might turn on him. Maybe they'd blame him for what happened. He's always, everything sort of centers around Lot and his safety and well-being. And so he decides to go live up in the mountains because he doesn't trust his neighbors. And of course, by doing that, his daughters have no men to marry. He just, there's two daughters and him. And so the end of that chapter, very disgraceful. His two daughters basically get him drunk and then sleep with him so that they can at least have a child, which was sort of the ultimate goal of a woman in that culture in that day. And so he ends up being sexually exploited, essentially. And these same daughters who had heard him shout to all the mob, you can have my daughters, just don't hurt my guest that I've never met before tonight. Now they're not going to be too concerned about his tender feelings. They're going to use him just as he was prepared to use them. And so that's the last real sight of Lot, is a business person that was always looking out for himself, was always trying to find the easiest path, the easiest road. And then he's kind of caught by surprise when, living a life that way, he has no influence even on his own family or any of his neighbors. And so there are times where God does call us to be served, to live, to work in dark places. I think when God can trust you to be a light, then he can trust you to put you in a very dark place where you can exert a huge influence. But he also knows your character, and he knows what you can withstand and what you can't. And there are times God will say, no, you're not in the place where you will influence Sodom, but Sodom will influence you. Better just stay away. Your walk with God is not such that I could trust you in a place like that. So Lot would have done far better to grow, raise his family in the wilderness, but he thought that would be too hard. And so Abram raises his family there and becomes a great person of faith and a friend of God.
Well, it's such a vivid picture of what that looks like to live for yourself and what that ultimately means. And so thank you for taking us through this, Richard, and until next time.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If this is something you enjoyed, it really makes a difference if you leave a review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends. We always love hearing from our listeners, so email us at podcast@blackme.org.